Chariot Solutions TechCast ETE 2010 Conference Session Edition. This is a keynote session from Michael Cote, analyst from RedMonk. I first ran into Michael's work back in 2008 when we put together the Chariot CloudCon East Conference. Among the many grandstanding blogs about cloud computing at the time, RedMonk was a place we could go to read about emerging trends, such as platform as a service and software as a service. Mr. Cote's body of work speaks for itself. If you head over to redmonk.com/Cote, you'll find a ton of articles and podcasts on cloud computing, mobile applications, and a variety of other topics. I asked Michael to speak at ETE last winter, and in addition to this talk, Mr. Cote has another session, as well as an evening podcast with Ed Burns, James Ward, Adam Coombs, and myself. So you heard from him several times in the podcast stream. Let's give it a listen.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm Michael Cote. I'm an analyst with RedMonk. And I used to be a developer and do real work, but nowadays I just talk about people who do real work. So that's pretty exciting for me. It's very low risk and enjoyable. And what I'm going to be talking about today is, you know, whenever I look at new technologies, even when I was actually doing real work, as it were, I always try to think about what I could actually do with that technology, and other than just getting excited about it and it being kind of like a shiny object and a distraction and something that, you know, is better than staring at the wall. And definitely, when you get to something like cloud computing, which I guess is, you could probably consider it the most hyped, buzzword-compliant technology out there nowadays, that actually has some actual real uses. I mean, there is a lot of sorting out of what exactly is going on with cloud computing. And what I'm going to do with this talk is very briefly go through some different perspectives of what cloud computing is, so you can kind of figure out this weird thing that you've got a handle on. And then rather than sort of get into the low-level technical stuff, because again, I don't do that anymore, I'm going to talk about sort of some of the uses that are both aspirational and very practical, pragmatic, I guess you could say, that I'm sort of hoping software as a whole, and then of course development, gets into using cloud computing for, with the sort of overall goal of bettering the software process, if not incrementally, maybe a little bit more. So I always like to start with the conclusions in case you get bored or you pass out or you want to get some coffee or something. And that way, you know, you kind of get your full buck without having to listen to me fully. And so the conclusions that I'm going to get to, and also to be, you know, to be frank, it's nice to have, I always found when I, or and still find when I study something, that if I know what you're trying to convince me of, it's nice to know it ahead of time so I can ratchet everything onto that as I hear it. And when I look at cloud computing nowadays and talk with people about it, you know, I think these are some of the things that I get around to. And first off, you know, for me, software, you're creating software. One, it's fun to do on its own. But ultimately, especially if you're in an enterprise, if you're in the business of making money from software, your goal really tends to be, at the end of the day, how are you going to make your users happier and more friendly with their application? You know, if someone hates the product that you're creating, not only, hopefully, that makes you feel bad, but it's also probably not good for business. So when you're looking at something like cloud computing or any technology, I always feel like in the back of your head you should be thinking, how can I use this tool to make my users happier, to make their lives better? And, I mean, if you're not doing that, then you're probably working on enterprise software. So that's exciting. And so getting into the cloud angle of stuff, you know, a lot of I think I've blown a lot of hot air about cloud computing for about 2 years now, from back when it was kind of like, what are those crazy Amazon people up to the proliferation of startups and the entrance of people like IBM and even CA and other very conservative, very mainstream people getting into cloud computing. And really, until very recently, and even nowadays, a lot of the talk around cloud computing is what I would call operations focused. It's all about, rather than developers like much of yourselves, it's all about the people who are dealing with running your software, the IT people, the sysadmins, the not really the DBAs. They haven't really gotten a nice grapple onto this train here, but you know, people who I would call the Morlocks of the world, right? They're the ones who run things, and There's a lot of optimization, and I guess every now and then they pop up and eat people, right, which is exciting. And, you know, a lot of the focus of cloud computing has been, and helpfully and rightly so, making their technology and their lives easier, optimizing the way things are running. And so when you sort of dip your head into the stream of cloud buzz, you don't really hear a lot about the way it affects software development and delivery necessarily. You kind of see the end effect and you see the optimization at the front. So I'm not going to try not to spend a lot of time talking about operations, but I think now is a good time so there's enough cloud stuff that's kind of coalesced and become real enough and sort of low enough risk to figure out using, if you will, that it really is time for development to start thinking from a development mindset, how you take advantage of not only cloud computing, but practices and tools and things that have emerged from cloud computing. And as we go through this, and as I think about how development kind of might find the cloud helpful, a lot of what I see is, thankfully, we have the whole agile, you know, software development train of thought, if you will. And a lot of the sort of the, to use an operations term, a lot of the release management practices that come out of agile actually line up pretty well with how cloud computing, to anthropomorphize it, how cloud computing wants you to deliver software. And so it's kind of handy that we have a pretty common understanding of agile, because really that maps quite well into what you do with cloud computing. So the next slide is something that's always it's always a rat hole or a very exciting topic to discuss. Like, I was joking yesterday that, you know, version control is perhaps one of the most boring and exciting things to spend your time as a developer like talking about. And this is one of those topics as well, where it's sort of like you can spend all day talking about what cloud computing is, and at the end of the day, you're not really sure if anything useful has happened. And to make that point, there's this great slide that I got from this guy William over at Oracle, who is actually, if you're really interested in the how to do the implementation and management of cloud computing, this guy like writes tons of fascinating stuff. And he's also French, so he's got a fantastic sense of humor that's kind of alien to us over here in Yankee land. Anyways, he had this slide in a recent presentation to kind of make this exact point that at this point, we got all sorts of pretty diagrams and stacks, and there's no end of definition of what cloud computing is. And, you know, more so than to tell you, you know, make the point that there's, as Larry Ellison would say, everything is cloud computing, and so therefore it's meaningless, if you will. And I'm not really trying to make that point, but the point that William also kind of makes, if you go look up his little short presentation, is a lot of what cloud computing is a matter of the perspective that you have, right? Like any technology, I mean, who cares what a mainframe is unless you're dealing with a mainframe, right? People who are using the end effect of it there don't really get too obsessed about it versus, you know, no one who uses computers cares about an Intel versus an AMD chip being at it, essentially. It's just sort of the underlying thing there. But then again, if you care about the chip, then tautologically you care about it. And cloud computing is very similar. You've got to figure out a perspective you're going to attack it from and then figure out how to pragmatically use it. And so kind of sliding into that developer perspective, if I can page here, I pretty much am very food-oriented. And whenever I encounter a sort of technology, I try to, you know, figure out how it relates to a hamburger, which is a delicious sort of thing. And, you know, a lot of people, they also prefer the layer cake metaphor, or a stack, if you will. But I tend to deal in burgers, if you will. And, you know, burger, nice three-leveled thing with a bunch of sloppy stuff in between. You might have a side of fries and everything. So you can see how the metaphor starts to work out for all sorts of analogies. And I think in cloud computing, you know, it's great to take the burger approach. And this approach is sort of metaphoric and more of a reasoning thing. And there's all sorts of good arguments and excellent charts about why things are more complicated. I mean, if you really want to blow your mind, you should go look up some ideas from IBM about what cloud computing is. And those guys are thorough. They're like, they've got it nailed, like giant slides of everything you would ever be concerned and obsessed about, which is fun if you're into that. But it's kind of also, you know, you just want to kind of get along with your life. And what I like to do is I basically divide cloud computing. Again, you know, you have to understand that the plane I operate on is trying to understand something at the high level, not necessarily at a detailed, precise, perfect level. And I really think of it as software as a service and platform as a service and infrastructure as a service, or the three asses, as I like to say, because I can't pass on a good chance to coyly swear. And the other nice angle to slice that on is to think about, and again, this is metaphoric, just to think about as applications, middleware, and server layers. And for, you know, an old guy with gray hair like myself, if I can reduce something through a three-tiered architecture, then I feel like I've won, essentially. That's sort of like how I was brought up as a programmer, and everything makes sense in three tiers. And so that's one sort of way of slicing the cloud, if you will, and piling up your burger. And then the other, now things get a little more dicey here as more people get involved in what cloud computing is. So, you know, these are just all things to keep in your mind to understand the context when people are throwing cloud stuff at you and telling you cloud's great and everything. So the other angle that's emerged is we have now a distinction between public clouds and private clouds. And what's going on here is public cloud is basically probably what most everyone would just call cloud computing. It's, you know, Amazon and Rackspace and hosters. It's stuff running stuff over the internet in a flexible, highly scalable way, and it's kind of what you think it is, essentially. And then there's multiple things that private cloud are. First off, private cloud can be, we've got a bunch of stuff that we need to keep selling, and we're going to call it private cloud. That definitely, whatever may be the case, as we learn from SOA and OO and everything, that's always the case with existing software. But more positively, private cloud can also mean two other things. One, it can mean duplicating the public cloud behind your own firewall so that you own all of the infrastructure and you're not freaking out about, you know, where's this running and what's my HIPAA compliance and, oh my God, the lawyers are going to freak out. I mean, it's kind of that sort of response. But you want to take advantage of running things the way a public cloud would allow you to run your infrastructure. And the other thing I haven't figured out how comfortable I am with this, but the other thing that private cloud is essentially, not to bore you with a bunch of IT management stuff, but it's taking the way IT management is run and using cloud technologies to make it more efficient, like I was getting at before. And what that really means is there's a lot of self-service and there's a lot of usually virtualization and automation being done and things like that. So if you know phrases like ITEL and ITSM and these exciting things, and then you know what a service desk is, there's a lot of people who are looking for private cloud technologies to be a way to make that muck run a lot better. And actually, I think that's perhaps one of the more, for IT staff, I think it's probably a pretty positive move. And it's sort of questionable if you want to really call that cloud or not. But what are you going to do? Sort of the marketplace finds its own uses for phrases, to use an old Gibson quote, I guess. So like I was saying, in the cloud world, I mean, there's basically, as far as brands and divisions, there's kind of Amazon and everyone else. And for whatever reason, Amazon is the king of things. And you'll notice, like, there was a... you know, they definitely have, they have the sort of the Apple top tier status where they don't really have to, they can kind of set the agenda and don't necessarily have to participate in things because they've been around forever and they have, as Jeff Barr showed in his talk yesterday, they have no end of technologies coming out all the time and they're sort of the benchmark for what goes on out there. Now, there's other people who develop all sorts of fascinating and interesting things, but Amazon's always going to be the comparison out there. So it's good to understand what they have to offer to have a baseline for what else is going on. So, you know, I haven't really gotten to some sort of fantastic definition of the technologies of what's going on in cloud computing. And I'm sort of banking on you guys have a vague notion of what it is. And usually what cloud computing ends up being, typically you have virtualization, though famously in the case of Facebook and some big public web consumer sites, they don't use virtualization, I hear, which sounds like madness, but they must have something figured out. So you've got a lot of virtualization, which means that provisioning and installing things is a lot easier than doing it otherwise. And on top of this virtualized way, you usually have a lot of what I like to call model-driven automation. And what this means is it's actually pretty analogous to the way, I guess, inversion of control tends to work, at least as I used to know it when I used to do a real job, where you're sort of... you're modeling out how you want something configured, right? You got your great XML file, and you're saying, I want this set to this, and I want this wired up to this, and you're making a model, if you will. You're being declarative. And you take that model, and you pass it off to the magic cloud machine, the magic automation machine, and it automates everything for you. So instead of, you know, you can compare that to having a script or doing a more of a procedural thing, where you're actually either literally SSHing into a machine or using something else that's kind of SSHing in for you and setting things explicitly, and you're actually getting your hands dirty. So we'll get into a little bit of what this model-driven automation kind of looks like and some people to point at. But that's emerging as a pretty key role in all of the types of cloud computing that's out there. And then the other thing, I mean, to be frank, the majority of applications you end up seeing that use cloud computing tend to be web applications. And of course, there's mobile applications that are emerging as a huge chunk of things that use cloud computing. But you don't see a lot of, you know, I mean, if you had a standalone desktop application that didn't need the internet, it's pretty simply not cloud computing at all. So usually it's a web application that you're encountering. And then another phrase that I'll kind of brush up against and you see spoken a lot about nowadays is this idea of DevOps, which, you know, usually has a little slash in it. It's always great to have a buzzword with a slash in it. And what's going on here, and what we'll touch upon in a little bit in the rest of the talk, the idea of DevOps is essentially that, you remember those Morlock guys I was talking about. Maybe you guys should be a little more friendly with them. Or just steal their jobs. One of those two things. Which could be very exciting for you, or you could start waking up at 2 a.m. because, you know, there's a bug in production. But figuring out owning the responsibility of your code running in production is a lot of what DevOps is about. It's sort of this crazy notion that when you have that wall, you throw your software over to the operations people. You're kind of sending your kids off to someone else before they're of age to take care of themselves, and maybe there should be a little more shepherding going on there. So I always think it's nice to have things to point at, if you will, rather than having coming up with my own good explanation. So here's just this sort of like a splattershot of a whole bunch of interesting people and sort of concepts that are more offerings and vendors that are involved in cloud computing. And at the infrastructure layer, so at the bottom bun, if you will, you know, obviously there's Amazon and the various services that they have, and there's people like Rackspace and all sorts of other folks who are, they're either genuinely new cloud offerings or they're existing hosters who are like, oh crap, I got millions of dollars of infrastructure, I better like make it cloud enabled. And usually they do pretty well at that. So you have a lot of people where if you just want to get a raw server that is programmatically comes up and is cloudy and everything, you've got some nice offerings there. And then at the platform as a service layer, there's actually, I see that I've excluded Google from here, which is just terrible. But, you know, there's actually not as many offerings in there. And I don't know if we quite understand the deal with platform as a service as much as we do the infrastructure layer. And you have people like Salesforce's Force.com out there, and of course Microsoft Azure, and the Intuit Partner Platform, who I think is a interestingly not well-known platform as a service. And then there's also folks like Heroku, which are kind of this weird combination of a platform as a service and infrastructure as a service. But what's happening at these platforms as a service way? Another interesting way, or sort of a metaphor to think of that, is really what you have this existing runtime, existing frameworks, and in the case of many of these, an existing customer base and all of the data and business processes that comes with it. And you're sort of building plugins or extensions, or you're extending that application for them. In the same way that if someone were to, if there was some sort of open source offering and you wrote some extension to that open source piece of software, and then, you know, the user you've extended the functionality of that software, if you will. And a lot of that is what's happening in a platform as a service thing. And, you know, as hopefully all of you know, whenever you build on top of someone else's technology, there's a huge amount of risk and lock-in and all sorts of baddie stuff that you have to consider. But it is an intriguing way of thinking about how you deploy your software. And then, of course, there's the software as a service stuff, which, from a technical standpoint, is tragically kind of the most boring of all cloud stuff because it doesn't really involve much technical to it. You know, there's just Salesforce on its own and Zoho is the great, like, they have everything essentially, and you have Google Apps. And then there's I do a lot of IT management stuff, a lot of Morlock junk. And there's fascinating stuff going on there. There's this little company called Poglo, which was bought by Citrix, and they basically have monitoring done through the cloud, if you will. So you just install this little thing behind your firewall, and it shoots all your data up to the cloud, which is a fascinating way of going about things. And then there's other folks like ServiceNow who have a service desk, which is basically the people you contact when you need to reset your password. And they have a nice cloud offering as well. And you can see the splatter of logos and other people over here. And I think we'll get into a couple of those people. But these are definitely sort of people that come up over and over again when you're dealing with cloud stuff. And like I was saying, the larger folks like IBM and CA and like very big traditional staunch people, they of course have lots of cloud offerings for you. Some of them great, and some of them, you know, repackaging and things like that. But there's good stuff going on everywhere. So the next thing I want to get into is, like I was saying, when you're dealing with something as nebulous, I guess, as cloud computing and in the technology area, I think it's really good to figure out the perspective that you're trying to understand and operate and deal with this concept as. And so, again, using the three layers of things, I mean, I think there's kind of three layers of three different perspectives that you kind of come around cloud computing. And if you kind of have an understanding of what these people's perspectives are, it kind of helps you understand the concept, but more importantly, helps you understand how you can operate and develop for the various layers there. So the first sort of perspective that you have are people who are users. And of course, you can kind of map out here that this maps to software as a service. I mean, for users, whether they're what I would call civilians, like non-technical people, you know, cloud computing is really sort of, it's more of an issue of just being an easier way of consuming computing at some times. And the promise is that it's a lower cost for them and it's faster to use, and there may be less functionality, but you know, you don't have to manage your own desktop and so forth and so on. So the promise for users of cloud computing is that it's better than the crap you currently have, essentially, which is always a great promise to make for folks. And I think a lot of what from a user's perspective, most of what you see going on in cloud computing is something that they either don't know is happening, it's just a web application somewhere, or there's business apps that companies are migrating over to cloud stuff. Again, to use the example of Salesforce or Google Apps or things like that. And you know, there's a certain amount of I guess, categorizing humility that you have. You're like, yes, I know email existed before the word cloud computing existed, and we've kind of co-opted hosted email as part of cloud computing and so forth and so on. And that happens with a lot of cloud stuff, is that there may be a very narrow thing that it actually meant at first, but it's come to envelop all sorts of things that are delivered over the internet. So it's just one of those things that you got to sort of take, if you will, as upsetting as it may be. So the other thing that's starting to emerge, which we'll get into a little bit, is that the way users consume cloud computing stuff and or applications supported by cloud computing, and I forget who came up with this phrase, but I think it's a really great way of thinking about it, is they use mobile, if you will, or they might even use their laptop as a remote control for the cloud, right? Which is kind of a strained way of just thinking client-server stuff. So you might have all of your data and your business processes and your computational stuff loaded up in the cloud somewhere, and you could be using a mobile device or maybe even like a little web page to kind of control the execution of that stuff on a remote server somewhere. And that sounds terribly basic and stuff that we were doing, you know, before punch card was invented probably. But that's like a lot, thinking about things in that terms, that you're sort of controlling the execution of a job remotely, is a lot of what you, at a very abstract layer, is a lot of what you see users doing with cloud computing. So it really is sort of moving computation over somewhere else, and they're just kind of remote controlling it. So for operators, those Morlock guys, I've kind of summarized this already, but for cloud computing, it means one of two things. It either means moving all your infrastructure somewhere else, which hopefully still involves you being paid to manage that infrastructure, or it means having a private cloud, which is basically using technologies from public cloud computing, like automation, virtualization, and a lot of self-service to really try to optimize what operations it's doing. And in a subtle way, when there's more, when I talk with people who sort of have gone like full bore crazy with cloud computing, what ends up happening with the operations people is they stop focusing on, as crazy as this may sound, sort of managing software. And they spend a lot more time managing hardware and infrastructure and networking and things like that. So for IT staff, you know, the when they're responsible for running for the service level agreements, for running software and providing a business service, they're sort of responsible for everything from the glass to the, you know, raised floor, essentially. And as tickets come in and problems happen, they have to deal with y'all's wonderful software and kind of report back to you and, you know, figure out, like, what's happening and so forth and so on. But when I talk with ops people who are more involved in cloud computing, their responsibilities, it's a fuzzy line, but it kind of tends to end at the application layer. And instead, you know, they kind of provide the infrastructure, the raw foundation, and then you guys are responsible for everything after that, which is an extreme version of what tends to happen, but it is kind of a fascinating shift. And then, you know, they spend all their time plugging in cables and racking things and doing stuff like that, which, you know, I suspect operations people would much rather deal with physical things and infrastructure layer stuff than application layer. And so, you know, we'll get into a little bit like figuring out how to deal with these people and becoming a little friendlier with them. So for developers, what I see emerging, it's mostly in the consumer space that you see people using cloud computing, but there's a fair amount of enterprise scale and every now and then enterprise use of cloud computing. But what cloud computing usually means is as I've kind of been getting at, is being a little more or a lot more friendlier with operations people and really taking on a lot of that responsibility that normally you would hope ops people are doing for you. And, you know, we'll get into, like, you know, it probably sounds horrible at this point, but hopefully we'll get to some reasons why that may be a good idea and the benefits that you get to it. And, you know, on the other hand, there are several people who, instead of becoming friendly with ops people, they either never get ops people in the first place or they just completely run around them and don't deal with them, which is certainly a strategy. But again, you know, you have to understand the whole point of an ops person is that you can have a good night's sleep and they can't. So that's kind of the thing you're signing up for, if you will. And the other interesting aspect that for developers is even if you're not necessarily deploying to cloud computing, if you will, or you're not doing cloud computing, there's actually a lot of great tools that you can take from cloud computing to use in your development day-to-day life and to develop everything up to that wall that you throw things over if there's not any cloud beyond it. And at the moment, just as with virtualization, where virtualization was really, it sort of found a lot of its early traction and success and value in QA and development. I mean, cloud computing is really finding a lot of its early value there. And then ultimately, you know, to be all to be all rainbows and sandals and everything. I think what cloud computing does end up looking like for developers who are doing it well and aren't getting bitten by it is they do become more intimate with the user, if you will. Like, they tend to be a lot closer to the user and get an idea of how people are actually using their software, and they get to see it in action if they're lucky. And because you're doing hopefully more frequent releases, you're sort of communicating with the user more. I mean, if you think about it, really the main way as developers that you have to sort of socialize and talk with users is through your code. And until that code is deployed, you're really just not really talking to anyone except yourselves. And so that's like the nice rosy thing that I always hope with cloud computing, is that it'll make the relationship between development software and users a lot more friendly. And so on that note, on the happiness there, in the middle part of the presentation here, I had a lot of debate if I should put the dessert at the end or the dessert at the beginning. And, I thought, dessert at the start, always a good idea. So this here, are sort of the benefits that I hope that development would get from cloud computing. And then, it kind of makes it easier to stomach the broccoli and everything that comes towards the end, how you kind of get to that point. And as I was getting at earlier, I think ultimately what I like to see with every sort of software and development innovation is a way of actually making the lives of people who's using that software easier. And I think there is some hope that the ways you would use cloud computing that you can get to that. And, to sort of delve into this more, and I think this quote from Peter Drucker, I think, is a great way of diffusing the wonderfulness of computers, right? Because if you think about it, the computer is pretty much a moron. Like, it only does what you tell it to, and it doesn't really care about you, and it's very good at and not really taking the benefit of the doubt about people who are operating with me, like, you really want to do this. And so, I always tell the people who get confused about complex things that you have to realize that you're dealing with a moron, right? And when you're dealing with a moron, it's good to keep things very simple and not really get afraid of it and kind of take the high ground, if you will. So it's a nice sort of track to keep in your mind as you're looking at this stuff. And so, it's that simplification that you're really going after. And I think the way... And this is very non-technical, very process sort of approach to the benefits of cloud computing. But what I see emerging, the way you use cloud computing as a tool to make your users happier, is you have this like lustful urge to get a lot of really cheap, fast feedback from your users. So you're trying to keep this conversation continuously going with your users, whether it's through code or watching them do something or actually seeing how they're using your software. And you're trying to kind of tune your software to what they want to do. And I think... we've got that whole science called usability. Like, any of you guys have usability groups? And they're supposed to be doing this. And I think they do this to an extent. But the issue is that the technology to support doing usability studies is really expensive. And the studies themselves are really expensive and time-consuming. And I think this is kind of a silver bullet mentality. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that most software is on-premise and behind the firewall. And there's really... You've got to bring people into your lab with your one-way mirror and all your fancy cameras and everything and study them. And that's a really expensive way to get feedback about software. And then you do it on these long cycles, and it's the science is there. It's nice and everything, but there's not really tools that support it so well. And hopefully with cloud computing, just by the way you're forced, the structure of cloud computing makes it a lot easier to do that kind of stuff. So let's get into some of those aspects. So the first thing... getting on the dealing with morons angle here, is when you're, ultimately, if you're a user of software, I think what you're driving towards is you want to have less to manage. You want to focus on the task at hand that you're doing and not really worry so much about, installing the software, upgrading it, maybe even paying for it. That can be a burden. And doing things that basically have to do with everything except actually using the software for what you want. Like loading pencil, like lead into your mechanical pencil is not really... that thrilling of a part of using a pencil. It's better when you're just writing and not thinking about it. And so on this less to manage angle, what cloud computing helps deliver there, how you deliver on that requirement or that feature, you will, is hopefully it's pretty obvious. First off, you're not really installing any on-premise software. So basically the way you distribute your software, rather than it being a cardboard box or an airplane full of high-dollar consultants who come and install it for you, what you have instead is you just give someone a URL, and they basically go to that URL and start using your software. And that's pie in the sky fantasy land, right? But it at least kind of starts there, that it's a lot simpler way to distribute the software. And then hopefully, you guys are responsible, whoever's running the cloud thing is responsible for updating it and doing integrations and all sorts of things like that. So in theory, as a user of the software, there's less moving parts, so your life becomes a lot easier. And the other thing, you know, that when you're thinking about delivering this from a development angle, I mean, the big question you have is a question of the responsibility you want to take on and the skills needed for that responsibility. So when you're thinking for yourselves, you know, this it's sort of like, you wonder if it's sort of like a zero-sum sort of thing, where if I give the user less to manage, does that mean I have more to manage? And then does my life become more difficult as the one who's delivering the software? And so therefore, you know, on net, we really haven't improved anything. You know, it's still, because it's harder for me to manage, I can't service the customer that well, so things still end up going bad. So you have to start thinking, how do I make it easier for me, the person developing the software and delivering it, how do I make it easier for me to manage? And the answer might be that you use infrastructure as a service, where, again, you know, you've got the raw infrastructure, and then you're still responsible for managing all the application stuff. And in the interesting world of platform as a service stuff, that sort of meaty part of the burger, you know, there might be some answer in kind of letting go of this idea that you have to own everything down to the metal, right? So you've got to own like the runtime all the way up to your application and be responsible and manage that. And the promise of a platform as a service is that all you as a developer, your life can become easier because all you're focusing on is what we used to call the business logic, the application code, not really like this infrastructure and worrying about clustering and replication and all these great things that, you know, we had that thing, what was it, J2EE, all that stuff. And, you know, it seems like I was saying earlier, there are risks with a platform as a service like anything. And, you know, there's a risk when you use, for example, the Java VM or the .NET runtime or whatever. I mean, at some point, you're locking into the layer below you, right? But with a platform as a service, that layer is raised up quite a bit. So you are locking into a layer. And there isn't really any short-term hope of a lot of interoperability in these platforms as a service. I mean, they're all sort of custom and proprietary, and I'm not really sure you can move between any of them effectively at all. But this is it's really worth your time to figure out if that lock-in risk that you're doing is sort of worth the ease of deployment and development that you have going for you. And, you know, to be frank, there's a lot of people who love dealing with all that stuff in the middle. So if that's part of what it means for you to be happy in your job, then maybe you just keep doing that. And the other thing is to think, so even if you're not deploying your software through the cloud, right? Even if you're not doing something cloud-centric, it's good to start thinking about when you're developing your software, how can you make the software cloud-friendly, if you will? Like, can you imagine someone deploying your software on Amazon somewhere? And, you know, what it means to be cloud-friendly exactly, it depends on various different things, but it's good to have an eye towards making it possible for other people to run it in this infrastructure and think about those infrastructure requirements that come along with that and the requirements for operations people for running your software. And, you know, I think, you know, the big shift that's happened over the past few years, which, you know, big shifts always have subtle consequences, is, you know, we used to have ASPs and managed service providers and things like that. And the technology behind supporting a SaaS are a lot better nowadays than they used to be. So if you tried to do a SaaS in the past several years and it was just kind of really crappy, it's a good idea to kind of like study that again and look at if delivering as a SaaS is actually going to work out in your case. So now getting to more of the, I guess, architectural ways of thinking about things. When I look at people, developers, who are successfully doing interesting things and also just having general success by using cloud computing as part of their development process and delivering through cloud, what I notice is they have this distinction of what I would call apps versus applications, right? And it's I think it's a nice little metaphor because the whole point of an app is that it's a much smaller chunk of functionality, right? So instead of having a giant ERP suite that you're developing that has all sorts of features and does everything, a lot of the people, developers who are deploying to the cloud, instead they focus, they almost have a feature per product, which can sound like the old best of breed versus, I always forget what the opposite of best of breed is, like best of breed versus enterprise offering. And, you know, you might have this mess of portfolio stuff to deal with. But it does seem like because of the ease of using software and deploying it and configuring it, sort of that tax of getting up and running with an application, if you will, one of the reasons you want to bundle everything into one big application, you can start delivering smaller chunks of software. You can deliver apps, if you will, because getting up and running with an app is a lot more easier than getting up and running with an application. And I've got two quotes from this guy, Brian, in this presentation here. It's an interview I did on one of my shows, my podcast, RIA Weekly. And So he works, you know, I think this quote summarizes this concept pretty well. So what he does at his company Alterity is he's like, you know, the head honcho tech guy, essentially. And what they've done is this is all exciting, boring enterprise stuff. Logistics even, perhaps even more boring than paperwork. And so he has, they do inventory software that manages the inventory for warehouses and, you know, make sure that you're moving your inventory from warehouse A to warehouse B and putting it on the right truck and all that kind of stuff. And they have a complete application, if you will, that does all this for you. And what they do is they operate on the Intuit partner platform, which I was talking about earlier. And so when IPP, as it's called, comes out, so what IPP does, and I don't want to sound like a shill for them or whatever, but it's basically you got all the QuickBooks users, right? And they sort of exist in this partner platform. All of their data, all of their business process, so all the billing that they do sort of just exists there. And what IPP does is it allows other people, like Alterity, to come along and build extensions or build plugins on that platform as a service. And if you start thinking about it, that's really an interesting way of going about something, because you've kind of got a ready-made user base or a market, you know, the marketing people would say, of people who could start using your software. So when you take this apps approach to things as they did, what you do is you think, so what's a way that what's sort of like, you know, whether you do a triangle or whatever sort of wacky diagram, how can I find the smallest amount of software I can write that has sort of like the maximum impact that I can charge a fair amount of money for, like a reasonable amount of cash for? And so what they ended up doing is, instead of duplicating a complete inventory management system like they already have, they made an inventory analytics thing. So essentially what this does is this little app that you get, it goes in and like it runs on IPP and finds, you know, looks through your QuickBooks and maybe looks through your inventory stuff and just does reports on top of it. And they don't charge as much money for this as they might charge for their full offering, but it allows them to bundle up a small amount of functionality that they can iterate over and deliver as a separate product, if you will, that actually is something valuable to folks. And you know, if you think about it, if you were back in the cardboard box days or the airplane full of consultants, right? If you delivered a piece of software that had like one function, like no one would really buy it. But the way you can deploy stuff over the cloud and develop for the cloud makes that a lot more realistic way of doing software. And the other distinction here is that, so they've developed this first application, and what they really are thinking of now is developing more applications on, like, in addition to that. So rather than extending this one that they have, they might think of other sorts of things that you would do with inventory and build separate applications that you use for that. And, you know, it seems like, looking at the way people, users and customers, are consuming applications, it seems like they are somewhat, especially in the consumer space, and we're trying to figure out in the enterprise space if that applies, but people are willing to buy these smaller chunks of functionality than necessarily buy giant pieces of software. And I think that really gets to, you know, a higher level point that because of all a lot of the things you see in the consumer world where software is deployed like this in small chunks of functionality over the internet as a cloud computing sort of thing, a lot of user expectations you see are to consume software in this way. And so people start to ask, like, why don't I, you know, I'm sure you've all heard the old cliche, why isn't your software as easy to use as Google or Facebook or whatever, right? Why does it suck so much, essentially? And essentially, you know, I think using cloud stuff helps you optimize to deliver to those user expectations. And the way people consume these apps is also another fascinating thing, which, again, is enabled by the infrastructure that cloud computing tends to take care of. And that's, they tend to consume these through centralized marketplaces, if you will, or app stores or whatever you want to call them. So instead of relying on, like, I don't know, Google ads or those little ads in the back of magazines no one reads or whatever to kind of, like, get to your user and tell them about the offering that you have, there tends to be centralized places where they can all go, sometimes built right into the main product that they're using, like in the case of IPP, where users just come up against this new functionality that they can install all the time, which, you know, this is more of a marketing level concern, but hopefully it's exciting to people who are developing the software, because, again, it gets to this point where the whole point is that it's a lot easier to have a direct conversation with your users, right? Which really doesn't happen so much in software nowadays, because their eyeballs are always on these marketplaces, and hopefully you can figure out a way to improve your software by taking advantage of that. So like I was saying earlier, you know, we've got this great line of, you know, little sub-team in software development called usability. And their job is to basically improve the experience of software, right? To make using it better, to figure out how people want to use it, what's not working, and study it, and kind of give that feedback back into the process. and basically say, you know, here's how we should improve it. Here's what we should keep doing, and here's what we should stop doing, and maybe here's some things we should try out. And the great thing, and this is the other quote I have from Brian, when you're delivering something over the cloud, if you will, over the internet, to use the old way of putting it, you theoretically, to use the cynical way of putting it, you can like go crazy with a bunch of Big Brother stuff. So you can, if you really wanted to, you can like really watch everything that your user's doing by looking through logs. You can look at their data. I mean, stuff starts to get scary, and you need to figure out some policy that like, yeah, we're not just going to like steal all of your stuff essentially and do a bunch of industrial espionage. But if you figure out that privacy freakout angle, what becomes fascinating is that you get no end of raw data about how every single one of your users is actually using your software. And so, you know, I'm sure we've all been in or I used to be in these meetings, and I'm sure you guys are in these meetings nowadays, where, you know, you spend hours debating if you should have some feature or you should keep supporting some feature, and you really have no idea beyond that one crazy sales guy out in the field who told you that he could close a $1 million deal if you did this feature, if anyone's using that feature. And when you think about it, that, you know, it's just because of the nature of behind the firewall on-premise software that you don't have all this tracking. I mean, you have, once you install it, you really have no idea, except, as the title says here, beyond tracking suffering, about how your users are using their software. You know, I mean, you know when something goes wrong because they call you up and there's a bug. So every time that suffering happens because of your software, you're acutely aware of it. But it's very rare, except for surveys, which are always kind of dicey because who wants to fill out a survey, right? You know, that you never really have an idea of the pleasure that people are having with your software. And as Brian's quote gets to, when you're delivering something over the cloud, you get that Big Brother thing where you can start to track, you know, that we know they use this feature this amount of time, we know they use this feature, and when we look at the aggregate of all the data, we can see how they're using the software and the type of data and the type of business processes that they're doing. And this really does take a certain degree of analytics, if you will. So you have to have this mindset of we want to generate as much feature tracking and as much data analysis as possible, and then figure out how to apply analytics to figure out behaviors that our users are doing. And once you get to that point, hopefully what you can do is to start make sort of experiments and think like, you know, if we add this feature, this will, you know, depend because of the analytics and the things that we've looked at, our users will, you know, this feature will optimize, they'll spend less time in our application, which is always a good thing. They'll be more efficient at doing this step. So, you know, maybe if we, you know, and then you can even get into things like doing A-B testing and sort of things where you have different subgroups of people and you could say, so let's say we implement this feature, we have a drop-down menu versus, I'm just making up some stupid thing, let's say we have a drop-down menu versus a free-form entry thing that we analyze, right? Like, which one of those is going to be better for the process that we're doing? And because of the nature of cloud computing and being able to deploy things, you know, over the internet and controlling it, and really, to be frank, because you can deploy different feature sets to different people if you do your coding correctly, which probably sounds anathema to the way you're supposed to do things, right, to have these different branches in production, just crazy talk. You know, what you can start doing is studying different options that you might have. So hopefully, when you get in that meeting again, and someone's like, oh, everyone knows no one uses this feature, just like Brian is saying, or you can actually like bring up some data and say if people use a feature, if they don't use a feature, and you actually have raw data to deal with, which I think is fascinating. And another thing that I got into in the little emerging you know, consumer technology to enterprise talk yesterday that starts to become interesting is a feature that you deliver. And this isn't necessarily, it's enabled by cloud computing, but it's not necessarily of cloud computing. It's to start thinking about how do you deal with the aggregate of information that your users have and not only use that to your advantage, like I was just talking about previously, but also reflect that back on your users. And I'll use an example that I used yesterday. So you know, it's a good time to check your email if you heard it already. And essentially, you know, in the boring IT management space, so there's some companies who are kind of starting to do this. But let's say you're configuring and installing an Exchange server, right? And so you've got, I don't know, 499 peers, I'm just making up stuff, who are similar to you and the similar company size. They've got similar demands on their Exchange server. And they've all sort of installed their Exchange server in this one way. And then you go and install your Exchange server, and you've got it configured in some wacky way that's completely different than all those other people. And so the service that's doing all this configuring and installing for you, it's theoretically what it could do is sort of use this aggregate analytics thing to realize that you've got your Exchange server set up weird. And it would basically ask you, like, you know, what's your problem? Why are you so special that you've got this server set up in a different way? And that's just an example to kind of get you thinking about how essentially, how can you automate best practices and knowledge management stuff among your user base, right? And there's a lot of, you know, one commodity business process is like a trade secret for you know, different people depending on how they are. So I guess like, you know, in inventory management, the way you deal with your inventory management in a warehouse is probably a core competency, and you don't want to go sharing that with people. But there's all sorts of things that among different of your enterprise users, it would really behoove them to sort of share the best practices that you guys can draw out of the analytics that you're looking at. And I realize that's all very vague and stuff, but hopefully the cheesy exchange example kind of gets you thinking about how would you do the equivalent of how Google can do spell checking, right? Like, you know, I'm sure they've got some linguists on staff and someone who actually knows how to spell things, but they just like, they look at enough text pages that they kind of get the common way to spell stuff. And that's a very simple example of this concept of you've got so much data that you can start drawing conclusions and then use those conclusions to help your users out. So with that little bit of dessert there, hopefully those things are attractive as things that you would have with your software, because they seem to be all around making the lives of your users better, which, I mean, I guess I did crack that this is enterprise software. So if that's not your priority, then never mind all this crap. But, you know, the way you get to that is you know, the summary of it, and a lot of what comes up, and a lot of cloud computing, like I said, is about operation-centric things. But what's emerging and what tends to be this DevOps mentality is that really what it gets down to is that you're trying to solve the bottleneck that is operations, that is deploying things, that's running things in production. And, you know, what seems to have happened over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so is at one point development was the bottleneck for getting new features out. You know, we had our waterfall process and our CMM and we had our UML and all these great sort of documents that were sort of the core competency of what we created. Like, we were really good at architecting and designing and specifying. And then, you know, hopefully we actually made some software that people liked using and was deployable. And I think, you know, largely thanks to just, to be frank, a new generation of developers, but also at Agile principles, the focus once again became on delivering the software and getting software that satisfies requirements out as soon as possible. And so I think in a very real sense, development stopped being the bottleneck for getting software through its life cycle. And then currently, the bottleneck is operations, right? So you can be delivering your theoretically, you know, at the end of every week or 2 months or 4 weeks or whatever sort of length of iteration you have your optimistically fully functional, we could release it software that's perfect. And then you give it to those ops people and they're like, oh, we're on a 6 week window, so, or a 6 month window. So, you know, which release train do you want to attach to? And then also here's a document of things that you need to comply to so that we can run it, and good luck with that. And then, so, you know, you're delivering all this software, you're making all this software at breakneck speed, and then you give it to this bottleneck and they're not really prepared to deal with that software. And, you know, and I think largely it's not necessarily a fault of their own, if you will, but what's emerged is in IT management, we have this concept called change management. And what that's really come to mean is preventing change, if you will. That is managing the making sure change doesn't happen. Because really in operations, like anytime something changes, you're at risk and there's like actual tedious, painful work that you might have to do. So a lot of the process that you have is built around slowing down change as much as possible, and this is a very cynical take on it, and so forth and so on. And thankfully, what's happening with a lot of cloud computing technologies applied behind the firewall is we're trying to fix that and make it so that change management is actually encouraging change and making change possible. And, you know, but again, as I was alluding to earlier, what this means is a slight additional responsibility that development needs to take on. And they need to realize that they need to have that responsibility of their piece of code and kind of take care of it throughout its life cycle, including in production and redeploying and everything. And I think the ops people are not, in the same way that you may feel that you're not really up to carrying a pager with you all the time, the ops people may not really be up to letting you carry a pager all the time. So there's sort of some mutual help and understanding that has to go on with each other. Which gets to the topic of trying to make friends with operations, which may sound ludicrous. But, you know, I think one side of this whole DevOps divide, if you will, one of them has to sort of like take the benefit of the doubt and start making friends with the other. And development people are usually, they seem the best position to do that because they sort of understand, they deal with their own operations while they're developing code. And so they kind of have an understanding of what's going on there. Whereas operations people, you know, their responsibility isn't to understand how to debug something or, you know, how to deal with exceptions and how to write code and things like that. But there's a certain humility that you have to take to become friends with people. And I think what that usually involves, if you want to take the high road and become friends with someone else in your organization, you have to basically understand what their concerns are, like what they talk about, what they worry about, kind of what their things are. And this is this can be really boring if you don't care about operations stuff. But in the operations world, they're all concerned about that change management process, if you will, or release management, a whole bunch of things with management in it. And there's all sorts of phrases like service desk, things I've said, automation, catalogs, and SLAs, and provisioning, and all this exciting stuff. They don't have ideas of necessarily like compiling and testing and designing and stuff like that. There's this whole other vocabulary of stuff that they do. And it's good to, if you're going to try to become friendly with these people, it's good to sort of understand this language that they're using. And in the same way, if someone came up to you as a developer and started talking about, they were using the incorrect vocabulary to describe the way components are broken up or whatever. See, I'm an excellent example of that in action right now. Then you would be like, oh, this guy's is a bozo. And like, I'm not going to really listen to anything he says. So you've got to understand the language that you're doing when you're dealing with ops people. And more importantly than knowing sort of like the Ivy Tower language, like the way things should be, it's always important to understand like the muck that they deal with. Like, what's the reality of the crap they deal with day to day? And it may be something as simple as like, they've got to reset passwords all the time. And, there's all these boring, tedious, less than ideal things that they have to deal with. And if you start to get an understanding of like where they suffer and like what the muck is, then it's a lot easier to get friendly with them. And again, there goes Keynote. I need an ops person to run it. So just kind of closing out here, when you're developing for the cloud, this is an illustration of my software career right here. Apart from becoming friendly with operations, it's interesting to think how deploying to the cloud affects the way you develop your software. And there was actually a great talk at like 4 o'clock yesterday that had a lot of nice little one-liners about what it's like to deploy and develop for the cloud. And it was basically like, all that stuff about failure. It's basically like everything's going to go wrong, which tends to be the failure of using new technologies. And there's different ways to cope with that and so forth and so on. And I mean, when you're looking to deploy your software to the cloud, these are some of the things that you have to start thinking about. And the first thing is that a lot of the point of cloud computing is that delivering software, configuring it, provisioning it, getting it up and running is automated and made easier. So you have to think about when you're developing your software, how can you automate every single aspect of getting your software up and running? Like eventually someone's going to have to type something, right? But if you can get your software up and running without like install processes or making decisions, and because you have to think about what are the different operations tools that are going to be used to deploy the software? Like what are the different standards and the virtualization platforms they're going to become deployed to. I mean, what this really gets down to is, we used to have this comfortable world where anything below the VM we didn't have to think about. Like the VM would just take care of that for us. And in cloud computing, that's not really the case necessarily. It might be the case in some platform as a service sort of stuff, but you really get ownership of everything from the glass down to the metal when you're tackling cloud computing. Now, the help is supposed to be that a lot of that is automated and made better, but you have to start worrying about these things and being concerned about them. And especially, everything always reduces down to some damn DNS problem, right? So you've got to get familiar with things like that and just basically the muck that I was talking about earlier that operations people deal with. And so, of course, you want things to be quick and easy to configure because the whole idea is that hopefully you're doing all this cloud stuff so that you can do a lot of configuring and deployment and updating and releasing very often instead of just sort of releasing and forgetting about something. And so what this gets down to is there's this great phrase that we'll get to next called operations as code, if you will. And once you have an understanding of kind of like the muck and the runtime that you're deploying to in the cloud, then you kind of it's kind of refreshing. You can take a developer mindset and think like, all right, what if I had to program this infrastructure? Like what if this infrastructure was programmable essentially? And that's kind of the mindset that I see people taking when they're deploying for the cloud. They don't really think of like, SSHing and copying things and installing things. They more think of the infrastructure as just another component of their software. So the infrastructure something's running on really does become part of the application itself. And I think that tends to be a pretty big shift for how you think about things, not least of which because, my generation of developers was taught that if you're worried about anything beyond the VM, you're doing yourself a disservice. But in cloud computing, you really take on responsibility for everything. And a good way to think about, to test what this looks like, is what's called the window test, or I'm sure it's called the steamroller test, or it's some sort of test where something gets utterly destroyed, right? And so think about your application deployed in the wild, and let's assume through some magic the data is fine. So like the state of it is somehow preserved correctly, but everything else gets demolished, right? Like the servers are demolished, the configuration is demolished, the code is demolished, and all you have is like your version control system with the piece of software. And like in as few steps possible, like think about how you would as quickly as possible build back up to that application in runtime. And a lot of the utopic promises of cloud computing is that it's just, you know, a few clicks and boom, you're back up and running again. And there's some people who get to that point depending on the level, the slider bar of complexity and simplicity they get to. But just think about if your production software was eradicated, how you would have your users recover from that. And a lot of the automation and stuff that's built around the cloud is geared for that. So, you know, here's just sort of a little, some actual meaty content. There's this idea, again, of operations as code. And there's a few people, namely these folks at Puppet Labs, newly named, and OpsCode at Chef, who sort of, like, are really into this idea as operations as code. And you know, I can't help but sneak in PowerShell, which came out many years ago. It's a Microsoft thing. And it's just like, I mean, if you haven't seen PowerShell, it's just like this, like, how did that Unix thing slip into Windows? It's great. It's fascinating. But each of these technologies is basically a way, sort of way beyond scripting, that you can start treating your infrastructure as code. You can start programming your infrastructure. And then if you take that to another level, not only are you programming in like a little like, you know, I always forget the name, but you know, a little console or whatever, a little interpretive shell, but you start saving those scripts and you check those scripts, scripts is the wrong word, but you start checking those things into version control and versioning them. And all of this configuration setup that you're doing, again, becomes part of your application. It's sort of the same order of the code that you have. So the mechanisms by which your software is installed and configured and monitored and maintained become part of the application itself rather than some separate weird thing, you know, maintained in bash scripts. So just only a few more slides here. And the, you know, One vendor's take on this, and it's sort of a collection of vendors, and it's this consulting company that has an open source thing called DTO Solutions, and what they call it is fully automated provisioning. And they have an interesting sort of white paper that kind of takes a crack at what would be the stack of software you would need to get to this operations as code to solve the Windows test. And you know, I just have it in here as a reference of, you know, I'm not sure if it's sort of like the perfect solution or whatever, but it does a really good job in about 6 or 8 pages with some fancy burger diagrams there of laying out what this stack looks like and what people are actually using, and more importantly, the concerns and the shift of responsibility that you go through. So I think it's kind of worth checking that out as an interesting approach to this. So lastly, like I was saying, even if you're not really deploying to cloud computing, there's a wealth of great things you can take advantage of just in the development process from cloud computing. And I'd be remiss if I didn't just kind of go over tools that you have. And the main thing to think about is there's this great example from, I think it was a talk that JP Morgan Chase, or JPMC as we say, did, or maybe it was BOA. And they were saying, you know, the IT staff, the operations person was saying, oh, we got all this provisioning and operations stuff set up. You know, development comes to us, they click on something, and within minutes, we have a server fully provisioned for them. You know, it's fully self-service. And then, you know, but then you sort of ask, like, so then what does development do next? And like, oh, you know, they spend a few weeks getting their software up and running on it. And there's a certain missed opportunity there, I think, where, you know, if you code your software according to all this cloud stuff I've been going through, in theory, when you go to this self-service portal and you say, you know, I got a bug in about version 2 of our software that's 2 years old and, you know, currently at version 5, and they've got these 15 patches applied to it, and I need to go to, you know, ideally you would go to a web page and kind of select all of this, and you have the cloud-like infrastructure, if you will, that fully provisions all of that for you and sets it up, and you're ready to go and test it. And, you know, I'm sure there's folks who have that kind of setup, and I'm sure there's a lot of Ant and Maven script hacking to get to that excitement. But if you think about it, doing that when you're applying cloud technologies as a tool is something that the operations people should take care of for you. And part of that is you've structured your software such that they can take care of it for you. So it's important to think how far you can push this self-service stuff. And, you know, as with virtualization, what you see people using cloud as a tool behind the firewall is they set up virtual dev and QA labs, right? So, you know, let's say you need to test across 15 different platforms, you know, like Solaris or HP UX or weird things like that. And, you know, you don't want to actually manage those boxes or have them maintained. But if you have these virtual labs set up, you know, people can spin up these things for you very easily. And a lot of that is mostly just virtual lab stuff. But it's interesting to see how cloud gets applied to that as well. And this gets down to build farms and just having big grids of computers that you don't have to. You basically move from your sort of under-the-desk data center to something that's more running in your own little private cloud, which is incredibly useful for people. And again, you know, the notion of provisioning versus configuration comes up because you need to make sure that you're not just getting a naked server provisioned for you, but you need to really push people to give you a fully dressed server that's really ready to go to use. So lastly, after that little bit of ice cream and broccoli there, I always like to leave people with a little aspirational stuff, and it's also another chance to have a good pun. And, you know, I think with all this cloud computing stuff, you get this crazy-ass dream, essentially, where, you know, one day you're doing your agile software development stuff, and the iteration is all ready and done and super to use, and you could ship the code and everything. And you know, you're having a grand old time with the Morlocks, getting coffee and talking about the Big Lebowski and having a great time, and you don't hate them. And then you're like, oh, we got that released done. They're like, oh, that's great, Joe. And then they go back to their office, and they just click a few buttons. And because you've packaged up your software right and made it cloud-friendly, and you've got this nice little thing, all your little new features go out to the users, and everyone's like in this happy, cloudy world. And you know, it's nice to have that aspiration to sort of shoot towards. And if you get about 5 or 10% there, then it's probably worth the effort. And so with that, thanks for being lively this early in the morning, and it was a good time talking.
Thanks again to Michael Cote for speaking at ETE this year. Our podcasts are produced by yours truly and hosted by Chariot Solutions. We help our clients build great software. To subscribe to the podcast, visit techcast.chariotsolutions.com and click on the subscription links for iTunes or RSS. Leave us feedback using our Twitter handle, TechCast, or by emailing us at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. Our podcast theme is Free Theme Number 3 from podcastthemes.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.